Labor Exchange on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Denver Newspaper Guild and Colorado AFL-CIO. Our guest today is Carl Smith with Smart Transportation Division. We're going to talk rail safety.
We'll end the episode with a short interview with Charmaine Arellano, an SEIU 105 member, at a rally held in Aurora on Saturday, July 29th.
Welcome to the Labor Exchange, Carl.
Hi, Robert. Thanks for having us this afternoon.
So, Carl, I wanted to start, I encourage our listeners to go back into the archives and hear some of your story we've gone into, but I would like to start with a bit of a background in the life of a railroader. Can you take me through what a day might look like for someone as they get called into work?
Sure, Robert, that's a big task, but so for the average railroad conductor, locomotive engineer, railroad brakeman, they don't have necessarily a set schedule. So if you're on a road assignment, you're basically on call. So how this could work, this is an example. Get called to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. You come to the railroad, to the depot, you get on your train, you operate your train to the predetermined destination. We call it your away from home point. Most likely you're going to be on that train for 12 hours. So you get to your away from home point. Now it's 8 o'clock at night. You've done a 12 hour shift. Now you, in theory, you go to the hotel, the lodging facility that's provided for you. You get something to eat. You go to bed. You sleep a normal shift or a normal night circadian rhythm. Now, the next day, you wake up, but now there's not a train for you to come back the other way. Now that train for you to come home doesn't show up until 10 o'clock that night. Now you've slept a regular night shift and been awake during the day because you didn't know when that return train was coming. Now you're expected to operate that train 12 hours the other way back to town with not really good rest because you slept like a normal person the night before. Now expand that to happens to people at their home terminal where they have a family, they have kids, they have the average day-to-day problems, and now at 10 o'clock at night they're expected to go to work when they had no what we would call a lineup. They didn't know, there's no reasonable time to know when that next train is going to be called and when you're going to catch it.
Well, and the reason I asked that question is just that the work is so much different than I think a lot of folks in their day-to-day life. And so trying to get into that, the mindset as we talk about safety, I think it's important what you illustrated around the way folks sleep may be disrupted. We're talking 6 months after the East Palestine derailment in Ohio. For our listeners, can you give a little bit of background of what happened in that accident?
Sure, yeah. The East Palestine derailment happened in Ohio 6 months ago. Basically, a manifest train had what we would call a hot bearing, a hot wheel, that was slowly but surely disintegrating as it moved down the tracks. That detect the trackside detectors to catch that hot bearing and notify the crew did not work to the way they were intended to notify the crew. They notified the railroad itself, which determined that for business costs, they will keep moving the train to the next terminal where it could be repaired. Ultimately, the friction caused that bearing to disintegrate while in motion and caused the derailment. Part of that derailment were some hazardous material tank cars that then started leaking. Vinyl chloride was one of them. Made a determination by first responders that ultimately they were going to have to set that vinyl chloride on fire before it exploded, and it caused a mushroom cloud in East Palestine, Ohio. But in the process, this large train derailment impacted. People lived by the track. The community had to be evacuated. Lots of impact to not only the rail workers, but the community that where the derailment happened. The broader community, the water system, was impacted by the burning of the vinyl chloride and the leaking of it. And, you know, then as the National Transportation Safety Board investigation and public hearings showed that there were some deficiencies between breakdown of communication between the railroad and first responders to what hazardous material they had, what was leaking, and those situations. So it showed some serious weaknesses at several levels.
And listening to those hearings, I was struck by, in some ways, the banality of some of it. Like, it was, you know, as a first responder coming through, you need to know what's on these trains. You know, often the solution is to go down the tracks, find a phone number, call the phone number, you know, and get the information that way. It seemed like there was some of that in East Palestine with the wayside detector, the trackside detector, and we'll get into the defining that a little bit, going off, and that notification not going directly to the person on the train. Like, that's, it's not like a buzzer went off above their head. Are you able to explain that a little bit?
So a trackside detector, wayside detector, is set up on the track. It's a system, and it can be, there's numerous things it could be looking for. It could be detecting hot journals. It could be detecting hot wheels. It could be detecting dragging equipment. It can be detecting all three. And so then when those sensors are activated, the way it used to work is it would make a radio communication over the railroad radio system to the train, and the train would hear it telling it to stop their train, and the conductor would get off and inspect to see if there was an issue. Was the wheel hot? Were the bearings hot? Or is something dragging? To prevent that, the railroads, to prevent the delay of a conductor walking potentially a mile, mile and a half, 2 miles, the railroad determined that it was more cost effective for that notification to go to their operations center in Atlanta, and then a person at the operations desk would determine if this was something that needed to be acted upon or not. And if they did, then they would have the train dispatcher of that division stop the train. But that kept the crew who actually had those cars behind them now out of the decision-making process. And ultimately, that was a horrible mistake. And it ended up, if the original detector, which saw that the heat was starting to rise on that train, had notified the crew, that car probably would have been detected and set out to be repaired in a siding or in a house track or at a station, and would have prevented the whole situation.
And I think that's the point of our conversation, is that these types of accidents are preventable. What sort of things would help prevent that type of disaster from happening?
Yeah, railroad accidents are definitely preventable. There's three causes of railroad accidents. Poor track maintenance, poor mechanical maintenance of the equipment. And often what we hear is, oh, the number one cause is human factor. But a human factor can be attributed to fatigue of the workers, not having a good work schedule, a predictable work schedule. And the second part of human factor is inadequate training. The training has become very lax. We have people with less than 6 months experience training somebody else with less than 6 months experience at this point. The human factor, inadequate training, is a large portion when it comes to human error and human mistake on the railroad. But every rail accident is preventable, and it's an investment in the infrastructure and the equipment and the maintenance of those to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, how common are these wayside detectors for, say, a hot bearing, you know, a hot wheel in Colorado?
I don't have the exact numbers here, but between Denver and Cheyenne on the Union Pacific, I believe there are three wayside detectors in 100 miles. Between Denver and Pueblo, to my knowledge, there are three wayside detectors in 100 miles for the hot bearing, hot axle. We believe that there needs to be more to detect these potential failures en route and to notify the crew and to prevent a large-scale accident from potentially happening.
Can you just talk about long trains and their effects on safety?
Sure. Long trains are what they're called mega trains are impactful to safety and to the communities that these trains travel through. So when we talk about long trains, a mile is 5,280 feet. It's pretty common standard in the industry now. The trains, when I started, were averaging about 6,000 feet. So a little bit over a mile, 120 cars, 100 cars, that was about the average. Now to move more, do more with less to increase profit, railroads have come to the conclusion that they can combine two trains into one. So you could take 220 car trains and combine that into one and make that one movement. But what happens now is that train is 2 miles. You could have a car behind you 2 miles long. If you've ever towed a fifth wheel or a boat or a camper trailer, think about having that behind you and knowing what's going on. Now think about having something that's over 2 miles behind you. You don't know what's happening. So all that, what's called force and buff, rail cars, I'm Italian, half Italian, so I use my hands a lot, but rail, think of a train as like an accordion. It goes in and it goes out as it goes up hills and down hills. So as that accordion bangs together those rail cars, you increase the potential for making mechanical failures, for making track failures. And imagine if you have 150 cars in that accordion behind you now coming in to squeeze, boom, 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 then stretching out as you go up the hill. That's a serious, increases the potential for derailment, definitely increases the potential for drag on or damage to the cars and wearing those rail cars out sooner. And then with low, poor, or minimal inspection, those defects on the rail cars aren't being found. But then additionally, now you have 3 mile, 2 mile trains that as they're traveling through communities at 20 miles an hour, track speed at some locations, now you're blocking 3, 4, 5, 6 crossings, grade crossings, railroad crossings in that community, making not only the community the inability to get across the track for up to 30 minutes as the train is moving, but also impacting first responders, police, fire, rescue, all from getting across the track as the train is moving 30, 40 miles an hour. That you're 2 miles back and that train is still blocking the crossing. Everybody knows what it's like to be stuck at a crossing with the train going through. Imagine 3 miles of that and how long that would take. Now, God forbid, or intentionally, that train stops. That train has an unexpected stop that it has to stop, or that crossing is over a siding and that train is moving into the siding to make a meet for a passing train. Now you potentially have several towns, several communities sewn up and blocked together without the ability of first responders and the citizens themselves to get across. Politico did an amazing expose out of Indiana on a community in Gary, Indiana that has been sewn up by a railroad, just stopping their trains on their sidings, blocking crossings for hours at a time, and school children climbing through the train with no knowledge or expectation when that train could start moving again.
Well, and that's the scary part about that's that the crew, it's a long train, they might start the train and they wouldn't necessarily know what's going on a mile, 2 miles, 3 miles down down, you know, as a student is getting across the tracks. And this is, you know, not hypothetical either. And I would also want to say, as we look at these trains going through rural communities where services are already less, if that service is on the other side and you're on the side of the other side of the train, you know, that delay could be life changing. And so, yeah, that's, it's unfortunate that this is the state of rail, is that the idea is to combine, you know, two trains from one, less crew, and in, as far as I can tell, strictly to increase profits, which have been, you know, record setting and led to stock buybacks. You know, like, that's the investment I've seen the railroad make, is it, not in any of the old rail cars that rumble past my house, but in buying back their own stock.
That's correct, Robert. The railroads didn't quite get a bailout during COVID, but they got relief. They received federal dollars, lots of federal dollars. And instead of using those dollars to update their equipment, update their infrastructure, maintain their equipment and infrastructure, retain those employees that maintain, inspect and maintain their infrastructure, they use that money to buy back stock from the shareholders at a significant price, all which is leading to a very dangerous situation, not only for the rail workers across the nation, let alone here in Colorado, but when we talk railroad, just like East Palestine, what happens in the railroad, on the railroad, doesn't happen in a bubble. These trains travel through your community. They impact their travel next to the waterway. They think when things happen, it's going to impact the citizens of Colorado as well. And so that's why rail safety needs to be a high priority for the General Assembly, the Public Utilities Commission, and for the state of Colorado. We want rail safety here in Colorado. We want trains. Trains are good jobs, but we want and we need good common sense rail safety legislation and regulation here in the state of Colorado to protect everybody, citizens, workers, the public, and our waterways.
I want to ask you a question about the environmental aspect of railroading. You know, one of the things that I find most fascinating about rail is that it's one of the most, as far as emissions and climate, it's one of the cleanest ways to move that freight. At the same time, you know, a lot of what we move on trains is crude oil or other types of fossil fuels. And at the same time too, these derailments cause ecological disasters. From an environmental standpoint, what do you see the value of rail, and, you know, how do you respond to critics that say we only ship dirty things on rail?
Yeah, the rail is the best, safest way to move hazardous material, including crude. It's the greenhouse gas emissions. Moving by rail as opposed to truck, you're definitely reducing your carbon footprint. When it comes to moving hazardous material and things like the Uinta Basin waxy crude, rail is a much safer way to do that than on truck. The problem is, when you have a rail accident, it's such a big accident, because that one tank car of waxy crude or tank car of hazardous material often is 30,000 gallons as opposed to what a truck would carry. So it is the safest, it is the most efficient, and the most environmental friendly way to transport all kinds of goods and material, but it needs to be done safely. And that's where the state of Colorado needs to intercede and not prevent moving the crude, but shoring up our safety regulations, requiring better track inspection, requiring better mechanical inspection, putting in more detectors on the railroad for dragging equipment, for hot axles, hot journals, preventing long trains, and all those safety measures here in the state would make, if implemented correctly and enforced correctly, would make moving the Uinta Basin crude very safe and equitable for jobs and the environment here in the state of Colorado.
And are you able to just define the Uinta Basin crude? Sorry, I'm definitely mispronouncing that.
Yeah, the Uinta Basin waxy crude comes out of Utah. The way I understand it, it's not crude like we're thinking of crude oil. How it will be shipped is it's more like a candle, right? It's going to be in solid form, and it's going to be in a tank car, but it's going to be solid to load it. They have to heat it to load it into liquid form, and then it solidifies, and the same to unload it. They have to heat it to liquefy it to unload it. So while it's in transit, it is basically a wax candle type of situation. But, you know, for my members who out of Western Colorado hauled coal for many years to coal-fired power plants, here in Colorado, 2030, there are not going to be coal-fired power plants in Colorado. Moving this waxy crude will be a step to keep jobs until we get to a true just transition, an equitable and just transition for fossil workers. So we're very much in favor of moving the Uinta-based crude. We firmly believe it can be done safely, and we want the state to use all its power to make sure that it is done safely.
What are the things, the changes you think we could make in Colorado that could help us have safer trains traveling through our communities?
Well, Colorado's led the nation 4 years ago and passed a two-person crew law, Colorado's two-person crew law requiring a minimum of a conductor and an engineer on freight trains here in the state of Colorado. That was a good first step, and we thank Governor Polis and the legislature for being seeing that. Now there's 10 states that have similar state legislation, but now we need to move on to requiring railroads not to block crossings for more than 10 minutes to eliminate some of this the danger of that. That can be regulated at the state level. The state can regulate requiring more trackside, wayside detectors, looking for hot journals, cracked wheels, and dragging equipment. And require them up to 10 miles apart so that it can detect and protect the citizens and prevent a lot of this. And then, you know, limiting the length of trains here in the state of Colorado. Colorado is a mountainous in the middle, but then on the eastern plains, very undulating, hilly, rolling hills, valleys. 3 mile long trains, 2 mile long trains are a danger to these communities. And so Colorado has every right to legislate safety and say that this is too much. Too long trains over 8,500 feet are dangerous, it's unsafe, and we don't want it here in the state of Colorado.
What I'd want to say as we look at what an individual could do who's listening now that cares about rail safety, what would you suggest they do?
If you're listening and you're worried about rail safety in your community, reach out to your state representative, your state senator, to the governor's office, and let them know.
Is there anything else you want our listeners to know before we wrap up?
Yeah, there's a lot I'd like you to know, but the people working on the railroad are hardworking people. Their lives are their shifts are hard. We don't want long trains. We don't want to block the crossing. And we need help. We need the state of Colorado and the federal government to intercede and force corporations like Union Pacific and BNSF to do the right thing. Sadly, we shouldn't have to. But that is common business practice now.
All right. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate it as always. Thanks for your interest in our very worrying topic.
Yeah, thank you so much. My guest today has been Carl Smith with Smart Transportation Division. We've been talking rail safety.
Now we'll hear from SEIU 105 member Charmaine Arellano as they gear up for contract negotiations. Please note the audio has some issues due to wind and crowd noise. We've cleaned it up as best we can.
All right, we're out here with SEIU 105, the head of the contract with Kaiser. All right, we're going to start. If you can tell me your name.
My name's Charmaine Arellano.
And what do you, you work at Kaiser?
I sure do. I've been there for 21 years. I'm a medical assistant and I work in primary care.
What do you like most about the care work that you do?
Actually, I do have a passion for patients. I just love taking care of people. It actually just gives me joy to know that people have people like us that listen to them, that are supportive of them, that help them with their everyday needs. You know, I have a patient who he takes care of his wife and she has dementia. And when he comes to the clinic, I take care of her. This way he could have a cup of coffee and read the newspaper. Little things is what I love to do. And everything else in between. And just, it's something I've always loved.
One of the things I saw around your neck was a shop steward badge. How long have you been a shop steward?
I'm going on almost 2 years. I actually learned the contract on my own because when I used to work in after hours, we didn't have a manager. And so my mentor, who's been a union steward for 25 years, was like, Char, you need to learn your contract. And so I learned it from front to back. She's been trying to get me to be a steward for 10 years. And finally, I buckled.
What does being a shop steward mean to you?
To me, it actually means not only protecting people's rights and their job and making sure that I know the policy and procedure, but most of all, making sure that the members that I am supporting and a steward for, that they feel supported by me. Because if they don't feel supported by me, then there's, like, that's pointless. They need to feel support from me as their union steward.
So in a career that's lasted over 20 years at Kaiser, what's changed in that time frame?
Wow. When I first started there, we were a family, to be honest with you. As a matter of fact, I've made a lot of family members. My kids call some of my best friends that I have met through Kaiser, auntie, uncle. I mean, they're amazing people. At one point, I could take time off to go to my kids', you know, book reading at school. I get denied all the time and I have 21 years seniority. For me, the biggest thing is patient safety, patient satisfaction. If I cannot take care of my patients the best ability and the best capability that I can, that's an issue because I strive on patient care. Because when I first started at Kaiser, that was the number one thing that was instilled in me. And because they took all of our staff away, we're working understaffed every day. During COVID, it was our communities that came out and supported us. It was not KP. They told us to actually reuse our N95s. Our churches, local churches around my clinic that I work at, were the ones that were actually making us masks and bringing us food and just there for all of us. Everybody else got to go home and work from home. All of us, SEIU, every single one of us had to be in clinic and work.
So at this event right now, you have dozens of elected officials, other union members, hundreds of your fellow SEIU 105 members, and then the general public who keeps honking as we're going by in support. What does it mean to have the support of your community and the community at large as you try to get a fair contract?
It actually means a lot because, like I said, during COVID, it was our community that supported us. It was our community that took care of us. It wasn't our company. And so with that being said, to see the community again surround us with and embrace us with that love and be like, you know what, we're standing with you. It just makes it all come back together. This is why I do what I do. I take care of these people on a daily basis. And to show us the love, it means everything. It means everything to every single one of us. We need everybody's support in this. We will not win. We are healthcare heroes and we need help in this fight against Goliath.
This has been the Labor Exchange.